WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. A day after Hurricane Idalia slammed into Florida's Big Bend region, residents are beginning the cleanup. North of Tampa, Brian Bailey says his Hudson home is ruined, but...
I feel lucky from that perspective that, you know, we're not completely on the ground and we're safe. We made it.
I'm Jim Krasul at Ocean Isle Beach, North Carolina. What was once Category 3 Hurricane Idalia has headed out to sea off the coast of southeastern North Carolina after it plowed across Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. Flooding continues to be an issue in eastern areas of North and South Carolina. Streets are littered with downed tree limbs and leaves.
A federal judge is handing down some of the longest sentences yet in cases from the U.S. Capitol attack. CBS's Ed O'Keefe reports two former leaders of the far-right Proud Boys are sentenced for seditious conspiracy.
Prosecutors said Joseph Biggs and his co-conspirators were the driving force behind the violence that unfolded at the Capitol. Biggs boasted about storming the building.
January 6th will be a day in infamy.
But today, he wept in court, handed a 17-year sentence in prison after being convicted alongside Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio of engaging in seditious conspiracy to keep then-President Donald Trump in office.
Gas prices are again on the rise ahead of the busy Labor Day weekend in Clinton, North Carolina.
It's really expensive, so it kind of sucks.
I don't know. I think it's too much to be paying for gas.
The national average for a gallon of unleaded regular is $3.82. A woman from Utah who gave parenting advice on a YouTube channel is arrested on suspicion of aggravated child abuse. CBS's Christopher Cruz with more.
Ruby Frankie was arrested Wednesday at the home of Jody Hildebrandt. Police say Frankie's 12-year-old son ran from Hildebrandt's house to a neighbor's house asking for food and water. Police said the boy was malnourished and had injuries from being tied up with a rope. Frankie's malnourished 10-year-old daughter was found at Hildebrandt's house and she was hospitalized as well. The now-defunct 8 Passengers channel followed Frankie's family, showing her interacting with her children.
You knew that it was a bad idea.
Yeah.
You're still going to have the consequence of not having your nails done for a month.
Christopher Cruz, CBS News.
One person is dead and at least two are injured in stabbings at Georgia's Fulton County Jail. It brings to 5 the number of people who've died in Fulton County custody in just over a month. It's the same jail where former President Trump and 18 co-defendants were booked in the election interference case. Meantime, Ecuador's interior minister says inmates are holding 57 prison guards and 7 police officers hostage in the city of Cuenca. This is CBS News.
When you think of hiring, think of Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or CivicMedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. Proposed bipartisan legislation in Wisconsin would prevent candidates from being kicked off the ballot arbitrarily, according to a WPR report. The legislation is intended to add clarity to the current law after a candidate for school board in Milwaukee was removed from the ballot after turning in 941 signatures, but the Milwaukee Elections Commission didn't find enough valid signatures within the first 800 that it reviewed. The candidate was later put back on the ballot after further review, but lost the election in the end. According to a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel report, Wisconsin taxpayers could be on the hook for up to $2 million for outside attorneys hired by Republican legislative leaders to defend the Republican-drawn election maps. A spokeswoman for Assembly Speaker Robin Voss did not respond to a request for comment, and Senate Minority Leader Melissa Aggard said the GOP will pay any price to retain their unfettered power and usurp the will of the majority. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
When you think about early labor unions, do you think of Wisconsin? You should. The state's first labor union formed in Milwaukee in 1847 when the bricklayers organized, then the Carpenters Union in 1848. The National Labor Union didn't even form until 1866. A State Historical Society report shows Wisconsin's union members also pushed for workers' compensation and unemployment insurance legislation, becoming a model for other states. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
And apparently, Maggie Dawn, Big Newton lover of the Maggie Dawn Show.
I was so offended, Jane. You know how much I love and admire you. You're like my freaking radio hero. And then to hear you bash my Newton.
It's still bad.
You want the cakey part cakey. You want the jammy part jammy. That is like bringing me back.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
It's What's on Tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5, The Tap. 93.5, The Tap.
In nearly 200 cities to cut local air pollution and emissions, and officials say they're cheaper to operate. And finally, in Ecuador, in a historic national referendum, Ecuadorians voted overwhelmingly to ban oil drilling in Yasuni National Park in the Amazon rainforest, one of the most diverse biospheres in the world. It's hailed as a historic example of climate democracy, and it was also a victory for indigenous peoples and conservationists.
I will share that hailing. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday we were talking about I think it was the Washington Post had a story on, you know, credit cards, you know, balances are going up. Auto loan delinquencies are starting to tick up. And the fear is that, you know, the economy is going to collapse because, you know, the frame is, especially from my rightward-leaning friends, is we need a recession to tear down the successes of this administration. And this plays into some of that, I think. But as we talked about yesterday, I think what Biden is doing on the labor front, especially with the overtime ruling that they just came out with, you know, how about getting people more money in their pockets so they can pay their bills? How come we didn't hear that as the response? But here to share some thoughts on, should we be concerned with the rise in credit card debt and auto loans and possible delinquency? That's why I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come share some thoughts. He's the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, it's great to be in your show, Rick.
So I'm sure you saw the story like everyone else. You know, the credit cards are rising, delinquencies are happening, sky's falling, evidently. You see it that way?
Yeah. The sky is still up there. Big, beautiful moon. And I was looking at this, and I was looking, yeah, credit card balances are way up. A lot more people are buying stuff because they have money. And they're paying their bills. Credit card delinquencies are about where they've been historically, and in fact are pretty low, at around 2.5-3% banks overall. That's a lot less than it was. It hit a peak of about 7%, 2008-2009. So we have half as many delinquencies as we did then. And delinquencies are not even any higher than they were during, you know, better times and 2019. So I'm not worried about it. People are buying more stuff, but they're buying stuff they can afford to pay for.
So why is this now a thing? Why am I seeing this, that this is, the sky's falling? Why am I seeing that, you know, auto loans are, why are we seeing this?
Because it suddenly hit a number that had a dozen zeros in it. the number of digits in the number suddenly increased. But it's been steadily climbing for, you know, for like 2 years now in a pretty steady clip. And it just suddenly went one more digit last month.
Okay.
But it wasn't even a huge thing last month. Interest rates are actually up. That might discourage some people from buying more stuff if they can't, you know, if they've been paying by time. But banks are making plenty of money. I'm not worried about the banks, you know, more. I'm not worried about more banks failing. With interest rates up, they've been raising the rates. They're charging the people who don't pay their bills every month for their credit cards. And delinquencies are not going up any higher than they were before.
So the banks will be fine. That's the message. But what, yeah, about, just, what about the working people?
I mean, working people have been getting screwed for years. I don't think it's been getting that much worse now. In fact, the very low end salary wages, I don't want to say salaries, but wages for people getting hourly wages around the minimum wage, those people have been getting raises that have been keeping up with inflation on average. People at the high end, you know, those are the ones, it's the upper middle class people that are calling their congresspeople and complaining about, you know, the price of their avocado toast going up and stuff like that. So, yeah, they make more noise because they call congresspeople and they write in and they show up at fundraisers because they have time to do that. Working people who are holding down two or three jobs, they're actually catching up a bit because wages in general have been doing a little bit better than inflation over the last year or so. Not much, but a little bit.
Yeah.
But they don't have time to be talking about it all the time.
But for me, this is one of these moments where, you know, our media structures focuses on what's good for Wall Street, what's good for the banks, as where my mind goes, what's going to be best for my neighbor? You know, and for me, the idea that, you know, families are in a position that in a lot of chances they have to carry a balance because they got to put food on the table. They got to pay the electric bill. They got to get kids school shoes or, you know, notebooks or stuff to get them to school, that they don't have the disposable income. They don't have the wages to keep up. So they fall back on the credit card. And one of the things that's frustrating is I haven't seen a real push to make it to where people can be as fortunate as I've been to not pay credit card interest, because we don't carry a balance. Yeah. Because it's stupid to pay the bank any more money than they already take from us. But but the sad reality, and this is where I want to finish this, is most families don't have that luxury.
Yeah, I don't carry a balance either. I don't pay interest on credit cards. That's the old saying, it's very expensive to be poor. I couldn't afford it. But that's where the money trickle down theory is just wrong. Money is trickling up. When people pay their bills every month or get charged interest every month, that's how money trickles up slowly, little bit by little bit by little bit by little bit, you know, and makes the people who invest in banks and credit card companies and iPhone companies and things like that get rich. Money is trickling up in this economy. It's trickling up to the rich, from the poor, from the people that work for a living. And that's why we have to do something about it.
Yeah.
That's why we have to change the way our economy works, because all the money's trickling up and eventually there's not going to be any left. And the investors, there won't be any way to make more money because no one's going to have any money because the rich people are going to have all of it. And that's not going to work for anybody.
Now, you said a moment ago, it caught my attention the people who can't pay their bills end up paying higher rates because they're going to charge them fees and charge them all kinds of stuff to get more of what these folks already don't have, and then putting them deeper and deeper into the hole. I remember Bernie Sanders coming out a number of years ago saying we should put usury laws back into place and cap what these banks can charge people in interest, especially in these times. I'm curious your thoughts on something like that.
Yeah. I remember I looked at, you know, there's these personal loan shops where you can go in with your pay stubs and they'll give you a few thousand dollars and check that afternoon.
Those payday lenders.
Yeah. Those guys, I was looking at one in great detail a couple of years ago. They actually make more money from the people that default than the people that pay their loans all the time. Because what happens is they're charging somebody 20% interest they go on for years, and every time they kind of do well, the guy calls them, oh, you've been doing so great, we can loan you another few hundred bucks, and they get another few hundred bucks, and eventually they default, but after 10 years, they've actually paid the company thousands and thousands of dollars more than they originally borrowed.
Yep.
And those are the most profitable customers they have are the ones who default eventually. And it's just not right that they're just slowly transferring all the money, you know, from people that are working for a living and earning it to guys who, you know, have lots of spreadsheets on their computers and extract it. And it's just, I think Sanders is right. We should have some laws controlling some of this. I mean, we do have some laws, but yeah, I'd be in favor of having more laws regulating, you know, these high interest loans. Even the credit card loans on average have hit over 20% now. Average credit card loans in all banks, according to the St. Louis Fed.
Yeah. It's legalized loan sharking. Only they don't come break your legs. They just put you deeper into hock.
Yeah. And people pay them because they don't want their credit cards canceled. You know, because they need them so they can, I don't know, call Uber or have a pizza delivered or do all the things you do.
Or just pay their, look, you know, I had a friend a number of years ago who got himself into some credit card debt, ended up having to file bankruptcy because of it. And I asked him, I said, you know, how did you run up this kind of debt? And he said, look, you know, got to put gas in the car, got to get shoes for the kids, got to, you know, all of these daily, expenses, my wife lost her job. You know, it was all of this economic hardship to where eventually they got themselves 70 grand in the hole. And you have a credit card industry that just keeps feeding them, because what they know is once you file bankruptcy, they're going to get you another card because you're going to have to pay that one back.
Yeah, and once you are in debt, then every month you owe hundreds of dollars more in interest. These are talking an interest of 2.5 points a month.
Yeah.
You know, 70 grand, you know, a month later, it's another couple grand. And there's no way. I mean, people don't make enough money to even pay the interest, much less keep up with the principal.
So this comes back to your project, the Great Economy Project, and getting an economy that works for working people. The idea of, you know, wealth in this country has been redistributed. It's time to redistribute it back into a way that's actually, you know, beneficial for society, I think. And that's part of what you're doing.
Yeah, it's respect for labor, for work, for the people whose only means is selling their labor, their time. That's how they make money. I mean, that's their only way of making money for the vast majority of people. And we have to respect those people. And we have to listen to those people. And that's what we're trying to do. We're going to North Carolina. We're going to Wisconsin. We're going to Pennsylvania. And we're listening to people. And we're explaining to them why it is that they're falling farther and farther behind while people like me are just getting richer and richer and richer. And we're telling them that they can do something about it if they want to, if they contact their legislators, if they vote, if they, you know, do whatever they can do.
Yep. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Morris Pearl. Morris, the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. If you want to check out the work that they're doing, especially on this incredible program that they're running, the Great Economy Project, highly suggested. Now, you know, we talk about, you know, raising taxes and having an economy that works here at home, but I guess you just testified, what, before like a subcommittee hearing in Brazil? Is that right?
Well, it was like a seminar. It was a group that was putting on a big conference with a seminar for legislators and think tank people and academics and whatnot. And, you know, I was on a panel with an economics professor and the minister of finance and the head of Oxfam. And, you know, we had professors from both the United States and Brazil. And basically, I was explaining to them that the problems they're having in Brazil are the same kinds of problems we have in the United States and the same kind of problems we have in, you know, most Western democracy countries, is that the rich people have arranged it so all the taxes are paid by working people. So they just get richer and richer and richer. And people that are working for a living are falling farther behind, and they're not going to put up with it. And if they don't do something about it, they're going to have some different government that will do something about it.
Yeah. No, you're going to have civil unrest as well, which is, especially in a place like Brazil.
Brazil is going to have the presidency of the G20 next year. And we're hoping President Lula, with support from other presidents like our President Biden, makes taxing wealth, having some tax system that at least addresses inequality. Even the proposals we have are not going to move billionaires out of the billionaire category into the working people category, but they're just going to take a little bit of money from the billionaires so we don't have to have all of it paid by people that work for a living.
You mean you're not going to make, you know, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk go out and sweep streets?
No. We haven't proposed anything about that.
No. Finally, I got to get your thoughts on a potential government shutdown coming. What, 1st of October is what I'm hearing, maybe?
Well, yeah, that's when the official budget lasts till the end of September. That's this month, or this month starting tomorrow. And, you know, there is no budget starting October 1st. So there's no authority to spend money starting October 1st. And the problem is we've got 30 or 40 or so Republicans who don't care, who don't want to have a government, who thinks having a permanent government shutdown would be just fine, because they think it's just wrong to have a government at all. They want to live like people live in, I don't know, Mogadishu, and have warlords, you know, the powerful kind of running the country without any central government. And with 30 people out of, you know, 435 that think that's okay, you have to get some agreement of the other 400 people. And unfortunately, there's about half half Democrats and half Republicans or so, to do something. And so they're going to have to come up with some compromise to get, you know, some Democrats and some Republicans to agree on a budget for next year and get the Speaker willing to put a compromise budget on the floor of the House of Representatives. Because there's a group of Republicans who just, they want to get rid of the government altogether. They especially want to get rid of the FBI. They especially want to get rid of the Justice Department. They especially want to get rid of a lot of things.
Department of Education, Department of Commerce, Labor Department. Yeah, I mean, they've been very clear and open and transparent about their disdain for government. And this is where I think we the people have to kind of rise up. And I know we've been doing these 24 series kind of ticking bomb scenarios for a while. Do you think we have a shutdown in October real quick? Do you think this happens, or do you think they come up with something?
I can't imagine how they're going to get people to agree. They won't get they won't get the mainstream Republicans to, you know, to jettison their 20 or 40 colleagues and pick up a bunch of Democratic votes. But that's what they have to do. They have to get the mainstream Republicans, including the Speaker, to come up with a compromise that'll pick up a lot of Democratic votes.
Just crazy. But Morris, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff, my friend.
Great to be on your show, Rick. Thank you.
Thanks so much, our good friend Morris Pearl. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So also, real quick, want to give a shout out to the Wabtec employees out in Erie, Pennsylvania, who they have ratified their tentative agreement, a 70-day strike. You may remember we were there about a month and a half ago. We went out to Erie to talk with the guys who went on strike. And look, you know, what they were fighting for was a say in their work, to say, hey, look, you know, we want better wages, hours, conditions, absolutely. But, you know, as the new technology comes on, we want to have a say of where that work goes. And we want it to come to Erie to ensure that the jobs that we're doing are the next generation jobs. This is important stuff. This is protecting communities. And when we were there, lots of incredible community support. Also, the UAW today has filed unfair labor practices against the automakers, General Motors and Stellantis, for not bargaining in good faith or in a timely manner. This is again, calling in a very pro-worker NLRB, someone who's going to side with getting this moving, getting people to the table and making them hammer it out agreement. And this is where I've always said that, you know, we do need to have some parameters of time, because the employer understands that the longer they can draw things out, the more desperate working people can be, especially if they end up going out on strike. So this is one of those things that, you know, I think is really important. We'll see how this plays out. But I'm thrilled to see our activist unions saying, look, you know what? We're not taking it anymore. We're going to close this massive inequality gap. We're going to make sure that work pays. And, you know, I got to tell you, it goes back to me being a little kid. And I was just talking with somebody today about this. You know, I remember, and I've talked about this before a number of times. I remember as a kid, you know, that family that lived next door to us, that the husband got a job at Ford, and he would walk 4 miles every day to work and 4 miles back. But their lives got better immediately. I mean, so even as an 8-year-old growing up in the projects, you know, you saw a union job, better life. There was food at the end of the month. They got, you know, they got better clothes, secondhand bikes, a secondhand car. Eventually, they moved out of the neighborhood and across the street into the houses across the street. Their lives got better. And for me, this is this moment to be able to grab that kind of frame, that union job, better life frame, and to really build on this. And it's these kind of fights that are important. You know, the Teamsters and UPS, those jobs are family sustaining jobs. And you ask anybody, would you want one of those? And people say yes. That's what we should be working towards, ensuring that people have opportunity. You're willing to work hard, play by the rules, you should get ahead. It seems that simple. Now, for me, we're in this moment where inequality, and you look at the numbers, inequality is where it has been, you know, back in the not so good old days of the rip-roaring 20s, where you had extreme wealth and poverty. You know, I go back to John Edwards, and for all his problems, he was right on the frame of two Americas. He was right saying, hey, we're moving towards this direction of the haves and the have-nots. This is his telling us what is coming. And what have we done to address it? Chaos. We've gotten chaos. And the reason that we've seen this is because they don't want us talking about this stuff. Some good news coming out of Texas. They ruled the Death Star bill unconstitutional. That is a big freaking deal. Now, understand, you know, the part of the Death Star bill that I had there's a lot of it, but a big problem with is, you know, these local preemption laws, where, you know, cities had said, hey, we're going to have, you know, labor standards for our area. Well, the state said, no, you can't do that. We're the body. The Texas court shot that down. Also, the federal judge in Texas has stopped the state's ban on drag shows. That's got to send the right wing crazy. Yes, there will be drag in Texas. I don't care. I think I've been to one. I was well down the road. But you know, here's where continuing to fight back is important, because these little wins are important. This is as bad as our system can seem sometimes, and as slow as justice seems. You know, what's that Dr. King quote? The arc of justice is long but bends towards justice. That's where we're hopefully heading. So it may seem dark. You know, all the stories, all the news I see is, you know, attacking Biden for being old or not taking the stairs, or you know, just crazy right wing. You've got a state senator in Georgia saying he's going to draw his rifle and ignite a civil war. I mean, how much crazier can it get? All because they're going to defend someone that they don't want to defend in court. They want to use all of the anchors of power. They want to use all of the things that they can do out in public, but they don't want to defend it in court. You know why? It's indefensible what Trump did. It's indefensible what these fake electors did. It's indefensible what the very best people did or tried on January 6th. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. That was the day the Battle of Blair Mountain raged in Logan County, West Virginia. Members of the United Mine Workers of America were attempting to organize the minefields in the southern part of the state. The efforts to bring workers to union was met with violent resistance. The miners armed themselves and marched south. As many as 10,000 miners joined the march. They met armed company men at Blair Mountain. In the battle that ensued, 1 million rounds were fired. The mine owners even hired private planes to drop bombs on Union miners. The U.S. Army intervened and the battle ended. Despite not being successful in their march, the bloody battle brought national attention to the violence in the coal fields. But that was not the last battle for Blair Mountain. In 2011, there was a proposal to bring mountaintop removal mining to Blair Mountain. This type of mining blasts off large chunks of a mountain surface to get at the coal seams below. Protesters stood against the proposal. They argued it would be environmentally devastating to the area. They also argued that it would blast away one of the most important sites of labor history in the nation. Some coal miners took exception to the protests. In a CNN documentary on the conflict, one union miner said, quote, "Mountaintop removal is what built this house, sends that little girl to school, provides insurance for my wife." But another miner joined in the protest against removal. He told CNN that miners had been, quote, "brainwashed to think, oh, I can't have a job unless it's a mountaintop removal job." In 2014, the state prohibited surface mining at Blair Mountain. For now, but that is subject to change. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The people are revolting, in the very best meaning of that word. An inspiring example of people rising up against a trifecta of economic, cultural, and political oppression has just come to us from a community of seemingly powerless people living in a very isolated place. Long exploited, lied to, disrespected, and robbed, they revolted, daring to take on the biggest, richest, most politically connected industrial power on the globe, Big Oil. Astonishingly, after a decade of protesting, organizing, coalition building, suing, petitioning, and otherwise resolutely rebelling against injustice, these tenacious people just won an inspiring grassroots victory over Big Oil profiteering. One reason you probably haven't heard about it is that it didn't happen in any of the usual centers of media focus, but in the Amazonian rainforest of Ecuador. Also, this revolt was not led by some brand-name environmental group or charismatic political honcho, but by the Tagere and Taro-Manani tribes and other indigenous Warani people living in the rich biodiversity of Ecuador's Yosemite National Park. directly challenging the exigent crisis of climate change, the Warani rallied the region's young people into a potent political force. They successfully organized behind a national referendum to 1. Ban oil drilling in the region, 2. Compel the profiteers to remove their wells and pipelines, and 3. Pay for remediation and reforestation. Significantly, they specifically called for leaving oil in the ground so it would not add to climate destruction. And the proposed ban was binding, unable to be overturned by future lobbyists and officials. This is Jim Hightower saying a resounding 58% of Ecuadorians said yes. As a Warani leader noted, this is the day the planet started to win.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about, you know, inequality is something that's ripping this country apart. And the sooner we address it, you know, whether it's the patriotic millionaires and their great economy project, talking about taxes, especially taxing the rich, which I am fully supportive of, or, again, something else I'm fully supportive of, getting people to join and form unions and organize to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, whether it's any of that, it's the way forward, which is why I am thrilled to see our friends over at Capital in Maine with a new project. It's the Striking Back Project, asking the question, can American workers disrupt inequality? You can find stuff at that over at capitalinmaine.com. And I've got Tracy McMillan here. She is the project editor of the Striking Back series, of which I hope to get a whole bunch of people to come explain to us how we do strike back and strike down inequality. Tracy, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So tell me about this new project. I'm really excited. I don't know if you can tell, really excited about this.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, Capital Maine has been doing some great sort of nonprofit investigative news work for almost a decade now. And, you know, they're able to pull together resources to fund a 2-year series of articles looking very specifically at worker organizing. So striking back, right, is not really, my work is not to sort of bring out stories of just workers getting treated badly, right, which of course happens all the time, but to really spend time digging into what workers are doing across the country to improve the places that they work and sort of what the limitations on those improvements are in terms of sort of government policy, corporate opposition, even just sort of really lax labor law enforcement, that sort of stuff. And so really looking at, like, if, you know, part of the solution here is to have people coming together and fighting for change, and particularly in their workplaces, what does that look like? How does that work? What are the models that are working?
No, I mean, you know, I've been talking about the fact that the Biden administration right now, and look, I don't want to sound like too much of a fanboy or cheerleader, but I think they're the Labor Department and the NLRB. I think what they're doing right now is going to be extremely helpful in helping tackle inequality by giving people the ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, increasing that threshold before you're a supervisor to work 100 hours a week. I think there's a lot of good stuff. And I think we need more people telling those stories.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, you know, I am, as an investigative journalist by training, I am not somebody who is a fangirl of any institution, really, but it has been really interesting to see what's happened at the NLRB and DOL in the Biden administration. Like, I think that the, you know, particularly there was the CEMEX decision sort of, you know, just last week, right, that now if employers are found to have been conducting unfair labor practices, the NLRB will just recognize the union.
Yep. I asked the question back when the Bessemer vote was happening at Amazon. You know, all the unfair labor charges, all of the illegal firings, all of the stuff. Why couldn't you just impose? You say, look, sit down and bargain now. You screwed up. You had your shot. You had your bite at the apple. You blew it. It's time to now sit down and pay the piper. And now we're actually doing that. And I think it's a darn good thing.
Yeah, I think it's going to be seeing what the ripple effect of that is, like, as with all these union campaigns that are going on, I think is fascinating, right? I mean, just for me, you know, it's really exciting to see that as somebody who's followed labor, you know, for 3 decades, to understand what the potential for change is there is really important. So I know that, you know, we're really interested in some of the organizing that's going on with Trader Joe's, like that independent union has already filed under the CEMEX decision. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens there. And I know actually a lot of the other stories that we've been, you know, sort of starting to develop and keeping an eye on, you know, unfair labor practices are so endemic whenever, you know, folks announce for a union, you know, seeing how that decision gets applied, how retroactively it can be applied, what that means going forward is going to be really interesting for us.
No, and that's the kind of reporting and deep dive journalism that we need in this country. You know, I tell this story all the time. I'm old enough to remember when newspapers used to have labor reporters. And they used to have a labor page. Every newspaper's got a business page. We all know what Wall Street wants. We all know what Wall Street demands. But we used to have a page where workers had a voice, where issues that were important to working people was in the local newspaper. Those are all long gone. They've eviscerated all that. So to hear that you're actually going to start doing some of this stuff is really, as I said, I think really exciting.
Thanks. Yeah, well, we're really excited to get going with it. I feel like we kicked off pretty well with the stories we had this week about like a worker center in Minnesota that's working with local building trades to sort of remake monitoring and enforcement there. You know, obviously building trades can provide really decent careers for folks and like stable middle class income, but you know, almost 90% of construction workers in this country are not in a union. And right. So the partnership there between traditional unions, right, that already have that organization down, and, you know, a largely immigrant workforce where there's a lot of issues around documentation for being able to work legally in the country, right, coming together and figuring out, well, how do we make all of this better? Because that's going to help everybody, right? Because I think in the past, like unions history, right, there's sometimes been some difficulty dealing with non-union workers, right? And so to see folks joining in common cause there for us was a story we really wanted to be able to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know that there are any unionized residential home builders in this country. I don't actually know that there are any anymore. There used to be. And this is where most of your construction workers are, and most of them get abused. And I think it's important to point out, as you guys did in this piece from Minnesota, you know, how this stuff plays out, because then it gives us the ability, I think, to have actual substantive policy, you know, discussions on how we move forward and ensure that those jobs are decent paying, have, you know, decent benefits and are safe.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I think to counter the idea, you know, I certainly, you know, I've done more in my own reporting, done more work around sort of agricultural labor, right? But I think that there tends to be this narrative of like, oh, well, those are bad jobs, you can't really do anything about it. It's sort of, it's just so complicated. And it's like, it's not actually that hard.
No.
Like, we could do it if we decided to. And like, here are folks, you know, who don't have the resources of government, they don't have the resources of big corporations, and they're figuring out how to make that work.
Yeah.
You know, and they're drawing on really important work that's already happened, right, in the Florida fields with tomato workers, with worker-driven social responsibility, all that, right, like keeps layering in. But I think it's really important.
No, I mean, you know, you think about the good jobs today. You think about the good working class, blue-collar jobs of today, the auto workers, steel workers, you know, unionized truck drivers that are left, you know, the UPS drivers. Those weren't good jobs until they were union jobs. And you know, those were crummy jobs. My grandparents used to tell me how bad things used to be. In fact, my grandfather used to shovel coal off the back of a coal truck for 17 cents an hour, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week during the winter, and still not have enough money to put a roof over their heads. When those became union jobs, those became solid, middle-class, one-income, family-sustaining jobs. So you can't tell me that these jobs can't be good jobs, because I know they can be.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I once had a really interesting conversation with a high school class in Coachella, right down in California, in that valley, a lot of farm workers there. So I was talking to a high school class there, and I had done some reporting on farm work, and they said, hey, like, you know, you were doing some farm labor, would you ever go back to the fields? And I was like, well, no, but, you know, my grandpa works in auto factories, and those weren't good jobs to start with either. You know, people would work in the fields if they were safe. And they were paid decently, you know, like that's sort of what the difference is. And yeah. I think unions and just any kind of worker organization, right, can be really powerful forces for that.
No, anytime you give workers an ability to somewhat level the playing field, it's never going to be perfectly even, but just a somewhat of what the National Labor Relations Act understood, that the employer has all the power, has all the rights. It just gave workers a little bit of a leg up. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Tracy McMillan. She's a project editor over at the Striking Back series for Capital & Main, capitalandmain.com, the website. I'm really looking forward to this this series, asking the question, can American workers disrupt inequality? Because I believe inequality is what is really tearing us apart. I mean, we've got all this red hat, blue hat nonsense that's going on and all these culture wars. And I think at the heart of it is the fact that, you know, I grew up believing that if you work hard, play by the rules, you get ahead. That getting ahead part hasn't been around for a very long time.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, like certainly the American economy, right, we've really let most of there were a lot of buffers sort of built in the post-war era. And we've let those recede, right? So we don't really have them anymore. And now more and more workers are sort of feeling what happens when you don't have those protections, right? And obviously a lot of that's about big structural economic change, right? Because the jobs that were covered by the NLRA and all those protections under the New Deal, right? Those jobs have all become much less, they're not as common as they were in that era. And all the jobs that were excluded from the NLRA, which, you know, people talk a lot about agriculture and domestic labor and like the terrible racial history around that, which is really important. It's also true that almost all service work was just de facto, I don't know if that's the right term, but like service work was excluded, right? Hospital workers were not included. Launderers weren't included. Hotels weren't included. So all these jobs that have come to really dominate a service economy, they were never included in those protections, right? So all those industries, as they grew up, right, through the 20th century, were predicated on the idea that you wouldn't have to pay workers very much, right? And so now we're, as a society, we're paying the cost for having left those folks out.
So, you know, let me ask you on this front, is the focus going to be, you know, story by story? Are we looking at, you know, making policy prescription? What's the focus going to be so folks will have an idea of what they can expect when they go over to capitalandmain.com to check out the Striking Back series? What's the guiding focus, if that makes sense?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think for us, the guiding focus is what are the models that workers can use to really address the problems of inequality in our country? And I will say, you know, I think the default assumption is that, like, when you talk about unions and inequality, we just mean economic inequality. But for me, I think it's really important that we're looking at racial inequality, we're looking at gender inequality, both of which, by the way, right, are really, like, those inequities are much more modest when you have unions involved, right? So like the racial wealth gap, for instance, between Black and white families that are union and non-union, it's if you're a Black family in a union household, your racial wealth gap is half as the size as if you were in a non-union, right? So it's like better. It doesn't get rid of the gap between Black and white, which is something we need to be working on and taking seriously, right? But there's really strong arguments to make for unions, not just for economic inequality, but broader social equity as well. And I think for us, that's really important. As we get oriented with the series, right, I think we'll be looking to doing multi-part stories and more investigative digs than we're doing to sort of kick off right now. I think the main thing is to just make sure we're getting out some good stories about unions that look at not just the union movement, but the worker movement, right? So like, you know, I spent a lot of time in Detroit. And so like General Baker here is a big guy from the Radical Dodge movement, right, in the 70s, right, where it's like, you know, there's the union movement and then there's the labor movement. And labor movement's a lot bigger, right, because it's everybody who works yep. and is trying to make change, right? And so I think for us, that's something that I'm really keeping an eye on. You know, and I also come out of like a policy reporting background, so I'm certainly interested in that, but we're going to be working to figure out sort of what's the right spot for us, because there's a lot of folks doing great journalism. A lot of people are going to be covering labor. Yeah. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We need to figure out what we can do that other places aren't going to be able to pay attention to.
No, I mean, labor is the new black. I mean, the reality is there's a lot of, look, when we were doing this program 18 years ago, there wasn't a lot in this space. Now there's a lot of people doing this, and that is a good thing. The more voices we can get out there to promote worker power and the ability to make better lives, the better we're all going to be, I think. So, you know, in looking at this, when you're talking about, you know, the difference between the unions and the worker power movement, you know, where's the focus going to be? Because there's a tension there, I believe, or can be.
I mean, there can be. I think for us, you know, worker centers are as much a part of labor coverage as our traditional unions, right? So that's one of the reasons we wanted to kick off with this Minnesota story, as well as, you know, there's also a story about the effort to organize a union at Delta among the flight attendants, machinists, and the ramp agents. You know, because I think there are a lot of workers that don't necessarily think of unions as being for them. I think often that correlates with sort of race and citizenship and stuff like that. And that doesn't mean those folks aren't part of the labor movement. It means that they're part of a different part of it, right? And so we want to make sure that in our coverage, as in our society, right, that we're include, we understand that everybody is part of this, right? And it only works if we all join together and sort of work that way. So certainly we're keeping an eye, like I want to, for me as the editor, I really want to be looking at what are folks doing that's replicable, right? So is there something somebody's doing that's really innovative and interesting that might work for other unions, that might work for other communities? Are there interesting collaborations between unions and community, political coalitions, anything like that? I think that's interesting. What are the ripple effects of changes in policy? So this stuff with CIMEX, right, and the NLRB, that's huge. Right. So if that all of a sudden creates a sea change, we want to be able to document and sort of show that that is working, or if it's not, right, if there's a sufficient and effective pushback from sort of the employers on this and they're able to block that from actually changing the game, right, we want to be able to document that. I mean, and you know, we are definitely interested in breaking news and doing investigative work, and certainly like, we are interested in stories about union busting and sort of malfeasance and that sort of stuff. But the main thing is to sort of take a little bit of a structural look at it. And so it's not just like, is there a cool union campaign? But like, what's the bigger thing we can learn about building power from a specific effort or campaign somewhere? So for us, we're always going to be trying to pull back and take a bigger picture, which I think ultimately is something Capital Maine has been doing really well for a decade, right? And so I think for me, it's exciting to jump in and try and figure out how do we do this if our focus is just like, what are workers and unions doing? What are the constraints on what they're able to do? And how do we make it so that we can build sort of a movement that can push for more equity for folks?
Well, I've got a new website that I am bookmarking that I will be checking daily, capitalinmaine.com/striking-back-series. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at the Striking Back series over at Capital in Maine. I am looking forward to having you guys come back on to share some of this incredible work. But good on you. I got great hope for you.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much. Appreciate the time. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1991. 3,500 buses rolled into Washington, D.C. They were loaded with protesters there to participate in Solidarity Day. The AFL-CIO organized the event to coincide with the Labor Day weekend. They issued a statement, Why We March, outlining labor's demands. The purpose of the day was to bring attention to the concerns of the nation's working people, especially over health care. Other reasons for the march included a call for more public works programs. Another major demand was the end to permanent replacement of striking workers by scabs. Bernie Dinkin, Secretary Treasurer of the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union in Philadelphia, explained, One of the main purposes for us going down is to let our friends know, our friends in the Democratic Party who are sitting on their laurels, that if they do not support anti-scab legislation, we will vote against them, no matter what they've done in the past. The most important aim of the event was to show worker strength and solidarity. A similar showing of solidarity had taken place in the nation's capital 10 years before. After President Reagan fired striking air traffic controllers, a September 1981 rally had drawn more than 250,000 people. problem. The 1991 action brought out similar numbers. Despite the 95-degree weather, tens of thousands converged on the nation's capital. They came from across the nation and 30 countries. 100 buses and a specially chartered train made the trip from Philadelphia. Noticeable among the crowd were members of the United Steelworkers Union with their gold and blue shirts. 180 different labor, religious, and civil rights groups stood up on that day for the rights of working people. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, in talking about inequality, and again, this is one of those topics that, you know, I could spend days, you know, ranting and raving about, because the sad reality is what's happened over the years is we've allowed the very wealthy to basically rob us blind, and we've allowed the Republicans to destroy our social safety net. And what tattered bit of a social safety net we have, they've put massive roadblocks in front of and done all kinds of really screwy stuff. And I look at Mississippi. Today I saw a story that the governor there, Tate Reeves, has revealed that there's some text messages with his brother Todd and Brett Favre, who you may remember the whole Brett Favre thing where, you know, there was a bunch of TANF money, you know, the money that's supposed to go to feeding poor people, ended up in Brett Favre's bank account, like $1.1 million in TANF money that, you know, was given to him to record ads and give speeches. Now you go, you know, is it Brett Favre's fault that the idiots in Mississippi gave him this money? I don't know, and I'm not making a judgment on that. If he did know that this was welfare money, shame on him. And also, I guess this welfare money went to building like a volleyball arena at his alma mater, and you go, why? We're going to build a volleyball court and not feed children? What sense does that make? But this story breaks because, you know, I guess now the time has passed where you can just throw this stuff out and, well, it's over. It's done with. Because Favre, if you remember, was one of 38 people who was named in a civil lawsuit by the Mississippi Department of Health and Human Services, I believe it was. Evidently, a state audit, and this is the part where you go, the block grant people, I love. They're so cute. Because we know what happens with block grants, especially programs for the poor, they get stolen from. Evidently, $77 million in welfare funds was misspent. $77 million. Of which, what, 6.1 went to Brett Favre and Brett Favre's endeavors. $5 million was the athletic thing at wherever he went to college. Now, he has paid back he's paid back the money that he got because it was a PR nightmare. But my mind went into this weird place because this was a civil lawsuit. You see where I'm going with this? There were no criminal charges that I could find. Why weren't these people thrown in jail? All of them. A couple of them were indicted. Six pled guilty. But my mind went, what about all of these people? Because think about this. And I was going through this. I was walking this through my mind. What if you signed up for TANF benefits that maybe you underestimated your income and you got a little bit of a benefit that you weren't entitled to? Do you have any idea what they would do to you? I mean, this is, you know, it's draconian penalties for the poor. You know, as Morris Pearl said earlier, it's expensive to be poor in this country. But we don't make enough of locking up these criminals who stole $77 million. And you go, well, it's just, you know, it's just money. No, it's not just $77 million, man. It was kids like me, you know, living in
in poverty at the end of the month where there's no food in the cupboards. It's the families who didn't get these resources, who didn't get the help that they need, that we said as a society, we're going to make this helping hand available. Now, you can argue, well, we shouldn't have these programs, and I would not disagree in every case. I'm not a fan of handout programs. Never have been. Not a fan. I think welfare programs are not great. We should have jobs programs. I'm a big supporter of people going to work, getting the therapeutic qualities of a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. But we don't have that society right now. I know Republicans want to have work requirements. Yeah, they want to have work requirements with no jobs.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.